This podcast of Left, Right, and Center is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
The state of the State of the Union. Who is John Boehner and why should you care? Plus, Kenny Boy on trial and the backlash against that cartoon. Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, columnist for Fortune magazine and senior fellow with the Center for American Progress, holding down the center here on Left, Right, and Center. Joining me on the left side of our Santa Monica studio and the political spectrum is Robert Scheer, a syndicated columnist based at the San Francisco Chronicle and editor-in-chief of TruthDig.com. On the right, as always from Washington, is Tony Blankley, editorial page editor and columnist for The Washington Times and author of The West's Last Chance, Will We Win the Clash of Civilizations? And in the fourth dimension, from the independent political blogosphere, is our own Arianna Huffington, editor-in-chief of The Huffington Post. Welcome all from across the political spectrum, a very busy week. The State of the Union being atop the news, Bush delivered that classic, honored speech in the usual fashion. Tony, I'm sure there's a lot of directions we can go with this. The oil addiction he discussed, the Democratic response, the et cetera. But Tony, why don't we hear the what I'm sure will be the defense of the State of the Union from George Bush?
Well, it'll attempt to be an objective characterization of it. It was a sensible speech in that because he establishes his own report card for the year, and because he's not going to be able to get anything much done in Congress, he didn't announce he was going to try to get anything much done in Congress. So that was sensible. I thought it was delivered well. The foreign policy part was strong. I thought the language about encouraging the Iranians was a little weak, but I checked with some Iranian pro-democracy people, and they were thrilled with the language. So I'll take their judgment over mine on that, since they're the target audience for that passage. I thought the oil part was relatively inconsequential. It sounded more rhetorical than anything else. I'm dubious of the economics of alternative energy. I'm open to seeing that it actually makes sense. If the price of oil goes up enough, then the marketplace will do it. If it won't go up enough, then all the subsidies in the world won't bring it online in a mass way. So I thought that was a gratuitous nullity. Overall, I thought he performed about as well as he could in a very difficult situation, given his political situation right now.
Your excitement is palpable. Arianna.
Well, where do we begin? The line about us being addicted to oil was really very interesting. I speak as somebody who co-founded the Detroit Project 3 years ago, and when we were talking about this country being addicted to oil, we were accused of being un-American. But to have that kind of major line and the need for oil independence without any substantive policies, without even something as basic as asking for an increase in CAFE standards, in fuel efficiency standards, without closing the SUV loophole, without any incentives to produce more hybrid cars. I mean, it was purely rhetorical, as even Tony acknowledged. On the foreign policy front, it was fascinating that he focused on isolationism and painting this picture of any Americans who were against his imperial adventures in Iraq as isolationists. He mentioned isolationism or isolation 5 times. And it's an indication of how worried they are that in the red states, they're actually losing ground because many regular, hot-blooded, working Americans don't want for us to be engaging in imperial adventures abroad instead of protecting us here at home. So that kind of tension is something they're acutely aware of, and they try to preempt it by smearing anyone who opposes what's happening in Iraq as isolationist.
Bob?
Gosh, I hate to pile on here. I spent 30 years at the LA Times, and I would always hear from editors, don't be predictable, try to say something nice about the Republicans or something. So I'm scratching my head here because Tony's critique was even more devastating than Arianna's. He basically, I can't remember it all. It was gratuitous and nullity. It was the oil initiative. I can't do better than that. And that the president does not expect anything from a Congress that he controls. I mean, we've got three more years of an administration, and you don't expect this Congress to do anything. You don't expect to lead the country in any new directions. That's pretty startling. To blast, I agree with Arianna, I mean, this. I think it could backfire to blast anyone who's critical of wild imperial adventures that cost more. They just announced he wants another,
$70 billion.
What's amazing to me is here's Paul Wolfowitz, was made head of the World Bank. He's the one that told us the occupation wouldn't cost anything. It would just be the oil money that would pay for it. Then you trust this guy to run the World Bank. It's pretty scary.
It's a place for a financial optimist.
I wouldn't let him run my kid's allowance or something. But you know, it's I think what – I don't mean to put Tony on the spot here, but I think...
Oh, go ahead.
No, but I actually want to get...
Well,
I want to get an honest response. I mean, is it over? Because what you're really suggesting is it's over. And what they're doing now is this is a, you know, a falling back on a prevent defense, damage control, not to explode. And I think the only gift that the Republicans got, it was announced on Friday, that the Libby trial will be gratefully postponed until after the midterm election because one of the lawyers has a conflict in his schedule, which, by the way, so the whole country does not get to know what Libby did before the midterm election when we can vote because of this lawyer.
Let me answer your question, because here I will revert to my allegedly predictable defense of the president. The major issue facing the country and the world for the next 3 years is certainly going to be abroad, the radical Islamic surge that we're seeing, whether it's in Hamas, in Iran, in the demonstrations against the cartoons across the board. There, I believe the president is showing good leadership. Whether his strategies are right, only time will tell, but the Democrats have not offered an alternative strategy. And I think he's going to have his hands full, as would any president right now, with that. On the other hand, he's already got his tax cuts through. He's always got his education reform through. He obviously can't the body politic is not prepared to deal with entitlements. He spent 6 months last year trying, so he kicked it over to a blue ribbon commission, and that makes about as much sense as anything else, because I don't think either party is prepared to make the hard decisions on Medicare or Social Security yet, so why break your pick 2 years in a row? No, I think there's a lot left for him to do, but it's going to be mostly on foreign policy, as it was for Reagan in the last 2 and 3 years of his administration. They turned out being historic years leading up to the collapse of Soviet communism.
See, I think I had the same feeling that Bob had, and even more so. I was on a plane going to New York during the State of the Union. So when I got in, you don't land till 1 o'clock or something. They happened to be playing it on C-SPAN, and ordinarily, as a card-carrying political junkie, I would have actually watched it, or basically watched it. And after about 2 minutes, it was so much of the same. I don't know. I don't know if you share this sort of sense of depression or malaise. It was the same pablum. You knew the oil stuff and the healthcare stuff was a crock. And I started just doing other emails and stuff I had because I thought it is over. This is let me finish my thought, Tony, because it just in terms of for all the things that I care about, at least, nothing will change until 2008. I do think there's a huge domestic agenda. Healthcare costs are hugely important to business, and it's hugely important to average people, which is why they put it in there and at least had something so that they have some kind of rhetorical ammunition going into 06 and some proposals, which I think are mostly bad, but have some things that could be harnessed. But on most of the things that matter, it's totally – nothing will change in the macro debate or freshen or get serious until 08, you know, if we're lucky. And I feel like I'm in a position of just hoping that this crowd doesn't further mismanage what I supported in terms of a military effort in ways that make it explode more while we just wait for 08. Anyone else share this?
That's why it was really such a hugely missed opportunity for the Democrats, who put up the new governor of Virginia, Tim Kaine, to give the official Democratic response. And as Harry Shearer said on the Huffington Post, it sounded like a speech given to a lunch at the Rotary Club in Richmond, Virginia. I mean, there was absolutely nothing on the president's Achilles heel in Iraq. You know, there is the president basically with
all respect to the Rotary Club of Richmond, Virginia.
Proclaiming that we have a plan for victory in Iraq, which was definitely the biggest lie of the State of the Union speech. I mean, if Oprah were around, she should have had a show with him, asking him to just fess up that this was a lie. And the Democrats do not dare touch it. It's unbelievable. And yet that remains the only point on which the public still trusts Bush more than the Democrats, keeping us safe.
Let me suggest that the Democratic Party is one of its biggest problems is it has, for so many years now, not cared what people at the Rotary Club think. That's where the center of America is. They're the civic leaders. They're the businessmen and school teachers and lawyers and architects. I've spoken to Rotarians. They're wonderful people. They do charitable work. And if you would pay more attention to their concerns, you'd probably get more votes.
So it was very shrewd. It was a shrewd...
This was not against the Rotary Club. It was just about the total mistiming of this. I mean, it's perfectly okay to give speeches to the Rotary Club, but to give a speech on the night of the State of the Union that failed to take on this administration on foreign policy, and the next day Tim Kaine explained that he's not an expert on foreign policy, he doesn't really know much about Iraq, then why did they pick him?
They picked him because he's a practicing Christian and he just got elected governor in a swing southern state.
Well, which is also, and I'm a Mark Warner fan, but when he's touting Virginia's record, how long has he been in office? Like 2 weeks. So it's a little, I mean, the idea that he's sort of claiming victory for sort of achievement in Virginia is, you know, stretches even normal political bounds of puffery, Bob.
Yeah, I want to endorse Tony's defense of Rotary Clubs. and someone who's had to push books over the years, I've found them a very receptive audience. And I must say they're made up of sort of independent business types and so forth who I think are struggling under Bush. And I doubt if these are people who are very enthusiastic for the foreign adventures, which after all take their children as well as others. So I think that the real issue here in terms of the foreign policy success, and I agree with Tony, by the way, if this president does a reversal, as Ronald Reagan did, after all, he embraced the leader of the evil empire. He put his arm around Gorbachev. He said they had a lot in common. He rejected Richard Pearl. And that was, you know, the great thing that Reagan did over the objection of the hardliners in his administration. Truly, if George W. Bush at the end of his tenure says this was all, a wrong path, there's a better path and we'll get out, yes, he could do quite well. The big problem he has is if you make Iran the enemy and you have presided with your occupation over the coming to power of the surrogates of Iran, and that just cannot be disproved. I mean, the fact of the matter is Mukhtar Sada and these others have said if Iran is attacked, they will defend Iran. So you now have the historic enemy of Iran being ruled by people who are sympathetic. And cahoots even send secrets to Iran. So that's why the president has to walk in a very gingerly fashion.
While there's a lot of truth in what Bob says of the Iranian influence on the Shias who are beginning to form the government, Sadr is in fact a pan-Arabist and is an anti-Persian. And as a result, I can imagine a year down the line, we will be allied with him against other elements of the Shia government because he is adamant not to let Iraq go under the thumb of non-Arabs, or to wit, Persians.
We got a break in a sec, but just before we leave the State of the Union totally, I think Tony had a smart point in a column this week about the moment when the Democrats applauded the failure to do anything on Social Security last year, and it got a standing ovation from Democrats. And Tony, I think I'm saying it right. You said this was, you know, one of those moments where the party seems so nihilistic that it begins to and so oppositional that it sort of captures a sense that there isn't an affirmative Democratic agenda that has to include dealing with stuff like Social Security and Medicare, et cetera, et cetera. And I do think that's true. And again, but I think none of that's going to change until the 08, shakeout in terms of who gets that microphone for the Democrats, but it's a sorry state right now. Last word on State of the Union, Arianna Huffington?
Well, just to say that the day
you
after
look so pensive.
The day after the State of the Union, we heard a great Democratic response from Congressman Jack Murtha, who offered actually specifics about what we should be doing in Iraq. Remember, one of the great lines in the State of the Union was when the president said, second-guessing is not a strategy, and he's right about that. Well, Murtha offered a strategy of redeploying, replacing, reallocating, and reconstituting, a strategy that alliterates to boot. And that would have been a great moment for the Democrats to have had Jack Murtha, a military hawk, a war hero, give the response instead of the guy in the red tie.
Up ahead, John Boehner, Ken Lay, and that inflammatory cartoon. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller in the center. Robert Scheer is with me on the left. Tony Blankley in Washington on the right. And Arianna Huffington, also here in Santa Monica and somewhere beyond politically. Let's talk about John Boehner. Who? John Boehner is the new majority leader of the Republican House of Representatives, elected in a surprise over his rivals as the Republican caucus seeks to position itself in a fresher way heading into the midterm elections and for other substantive reasons, I'm sure. Tony Blankley, you called this, I think, in a surprise.
Yes,
a few weeks ago.
On the McLaughlin group, I predicted Boehner would win.
And
so it wasn't a surprise to me.
Well,
New York Times and everyone else.
Well, what's it all mean for the rest of us who didn't have your vision? what's the significance of this?
Well, first of all, it's easy to overinterpret on ideological grounds any leadership fight. There's a lot of personality. There's a lot of familial kind of issues that play out. But I thought that Boehner was likely to be able to take the middle position, which is probably where I thought the members were going to want to be, between sort of a fairly radical reform and a complete status quo, with Blunt being not only publicly the status quo, but he was privately playing the hand of cutting deals and offering chairmanships and all the rest based on his institutional power. And while that's usually a useful device, this was a season when obviously it could have a bad odor. And so also, Blunt had not done as good a job as DeLay before him. It wasn't like they were losing a legislative genius. They were losing a competent but not brilliant legislative manager. So there was less to lose with him. Boehner is an interesting guy. I happen to know him. He had been one of Newt's lieutenants back in the 90s, and when Newt fell, he fell with him. And he then went back to the Ed and Labor Committee and rebuilt his whole career doing really good legislative work. Whether you agreed with the policy or not, he developed a reputation as a legislator, someone who worked across the aisle, who could get things done in an amicable way. I think there was a yearning for that, and he had that skill that he'd reestablished with the members. Shattuck never had a chance, but was necessary to split the vote. As soon as Shattuck announced as the hardcore conservative, that froze in place a number of conservative votes who might have succumbed to Blunt as sort of the institutional front runner. But by the time that we got to the second ballot yesterday afternoon, almost all the Shattuck voters went to Boehner, and he won in a close vote.
So, Bob, any sense of whether this means anything more broadly? Does this change anything that matters in terms of the trajectory of policy, politics?
Well, I think it...
Your own spiritual...
I think it clarifies the situation to have one of the biggest recipients of the biggest amount of tobacco money and of lobbying money now in charge of the Republican Party, and so it defines what they're all about.
As opposed to the trial lawyer money and the...
I'm just saying that...
Rahm Emanuel, the person who never met a lobbyist?
For those who feel...
The Democratic... DCCC leader.
For those who feel he's just like all the others, and I don't always like to tout our own truthdig.com website, but we have linked to a devastating critique in which he is shown to be far more plugged into the K Street crowd, far more corrupted in that way than Tom DeLay. So I think this guy is going to make Tom DeLay look pretty good, and I just would recommend people check that out. There are other sites on the Internet that have that, but I'll tell you, it's a devastating. The public interest groups have come up with a devastating portfolio, and this guy is a man on the take of the worst kind.
It's kind of interesting that he's being presented as a reformer, as a new face that's going to change things in the Republican Party. I think his main asset seems to be a permanent suntan. He's the kind
What's
of George
tan?
Harrison of the Republican
Hamilton,
caucus,
right.
George Hamilton, right. So
he could be on Dancing with the Stars soon.
I think Tony should be given the job of finding out between now and next Friday what gives, what's the suntan, how does he get it?
No, he's of course, he's famous for having the George Hamilton suntan, for having a cigarette and a glass in his hand in the evening. He's a regular guy. And it's one of the reasons he gets along with Democrats, many of whom are also regular guys and gals. So don't poo-poo regularity in that sense. Neither party is going to have anybody in a senior position that is not cozy with lobbyists. Rahm Emanuel, the DCCC leader, the former Clinton appointee, who then became instantly a multimillionaire investment banker before running for Congress and out of Illinois, is extraordinarily tight with lobbyists and should be. I mean, that's simply the nature of the business. This is not going to be a money-free election in November. Both parties are going to raise every penny they can, and all of their leaders in both parties are going to be filled with connections. And over the next 9 months, I'm sure there will be websites on the right pointing out the connections of the Democrat leadership, and there'll be websites on the left pointing out the connections of the Republican leadership. There's not going to be, in that regard, a dime's worth of difference.
But
maybe more than a dime, because Republicans will probably raise a little bit more, but not for want of Democratic trying.
But, Tony, the question is not here raising money from lobbyists. It's the issue of selling public policy to raise that money. That surely is not something you can just accept.
Of course, bribery is a felony, and one wants to be careful about accusing anybody of it. But the existing legal and ethical system permits and indeed almost induces the members of both parties to try to raise money to run campaigns. If you run for Congress in Southern California, you have to advertise, because the LA Times does not cover what you say. If you on a regular basis speak intelligently to the issues, you get no coverage in the LA Times or in Chicago Tribune. It's not a reflection on the paper. It's the fact there's no space in today's news for what congressmen stand for during the year. So the only way you can get to them, to the people, is to buy advertising, and nobody's giving the advertising away, so you got to raise money, and you go where the money is. And that's what both parties are stuck with, and we can moralize against them if one wants to, but until the system is changed, both parties, and if there's a third party will be plagued with the same challenge.
Speaking of going where the money is, the Enron trial began in Houston this week. Ken Lay, the former chairman and CEO, and Jeff Skilling, who was his top lieutenant and CEO for a brief period before he kind of mysteriously left. Any thoughts, Bob, on what this moment means? Is this the comeuppance of crony capitalism? Is there another story is yet to be told, which I actually have a suspicion about, but I want to hear your take first.
Well, as you know, I wrote a column that, again, can be found on truthdig.com, and was in the San Francisco Chronicle as well, that the politicians should be in the docket with Enron. And if they have not technically committed a crime, and one of the problems is, as you guys being lawyers, both you and Tony know, the bribery is impossible to prove, because all the legislator has to show is that he had some interest in that area. And even though he took money, their views happen to coincide. So the laws
– we're talking about Enron now.
I'm going to get to that. So what happened in this specific case is Enron would not exist as a major company were it not for old Senator Phil Graham from Texas and his wife Wendy Graham, who was head of the Commodities Futures Trading Board under the first Bush administration. It was Wendy Graham that gave Enron its key exemption on futures tradings and removed it from regulation, allowing Enron's first burst of growth. And it was Phil Graham who pioneered freeing all of Enron's basic trading activities from any kind of government regulation. So the whole nightmare of Enron Online, that scam California, the enormous fiasco here was made possible only because of changes in the law and deregulation brought about by two leading Republicans, if you like, and supported by the first Bush administration and the second Bush administration. And let me just add one little point. And when George W. came in, he opposed Clinton's attempt to move against offshore tax havens, of which Enron was employing 844 of them.
The one thing I appreciate a lot what you're saying, but the one thing I remain curious about that I hope gets a hearing during this trial is that the actual collapse of the firm, I understand there were shenanigans going on. I understand the California situation. I understand Andy Fastow and these off-the-books, self-dealing things, et cetera, et cetera. But Skilling always maintained, and it's never been sort of fully aired, that the actual collapse of the firm was caused by this kind of spiraling cascade of events once the bad publicity triggered by some of these things happened. And it was a kind of run-on-the-bank situation that led to the actual folding of the firm that he always says wouldn't have had to happen absent some of that stuff. And I have, again, this is not a fully informed view because it would be a lifestyle choice to have a fully informed view on this, but I have at least a hint of a suspicion that there's something in that, and I hope that somewhere in this incredibly complicated trial we'll hear something about that. We've only got about 30 seconds or so before we rant, unfortunately. I did just want us to hit this incredible backlash that's happening across Europe to the cartoon that apparently I have not seen the cartoon, but is inflaming Muslims around the world, or at least some Muslims, and creating this incredible backlash. We may have to come back to this because I'm sure this story will continue. But Tony or Ariana, any brief, literally sort of 20-second thoughts on that? Ariana shaking her head no, haven't seen cartoon, can't opine.
Yes, Tony? Yeah, I mean, the first chapter of my book, I describe mass Muslim rioting and demonstrating because they're offended by the blasphemous nature of artistic representations in Europe. This is inevitably going to happen. It's not just terrorists. The dangerous thing about this is that any strict Muslim is going to be offended by this, but it's going to give cover to the vastly smaller number of people who might be motivated towards violence. So this is a very dangerous situation.
We'll come back to it. We have reached that time once again for our famed end of show, Left, Right, and Center Rant, featuring pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum. Just about 15 seconds each. Ariana Huffington, it's your soapbox.
Just 15 more seconds on the president's absurd pronouncement that he's going to make us free of our dependence on foreign oil, when in fact his own energy bill does not even have what they had been recommended, a 10% reduction in the use of fossil fuels in the production of electricity by 2020.
Bob Scheer.
Yeah, I want to just comment on the cartoon issue. What we're seeing is there's an enormous battle been going on within the Muslim world between secular forces and religious fundamentalist forces. Unfortunately, Bush's invasion of Iraq has inflamed the fundamentalist forces, has given them ammunition, has given them a recruiting poster, and the secular people, whether they were dictators or Democrats, are on the run.
Tony Blankley.
There was a baby bear born at the National Zoo recently. He got very little publicity because he was a sloth bear rather than a panda bear. I ran a very nice picture of the sloth bear, not quite as cute, admittedly, as a panda bear, but deserving of more attention than he gets.
In other cultural landmark or milestones, I just want to note the passing of the Western Union telegram. I was sort of stunned, I guess. I hadn't thought about anyone sending telegrams. I haven't sent one in as long as I can remember. But the Western Union telegram was officially put to rest by Western Union. This week, it's going to be shifting its focus to the money wiring business. Another victim of modern technology. That's all the victims we have time for today, though, on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, as always, to my co-hosts, Bob Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Ariana Huffington. Sarah Spitz produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. I'm Matt Miller. Thanks for listening. Tune in again next week for another edition of Left, Right, and Center.
Whoa, so if you like pajamas, I'll wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
For we know we need each other, so we better call the calling of all.
Audio archives and podcasts of KCRW programs are at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about Left, Right, and Center, email lrc@kcrw.com. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by 89.9 KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com.
You've been listening to KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Le Show, a weekly romp through the worlds of media, politics, sports, and show business with satirist Harry Shearer. Check out the podcast of Le Show at kcrw.com.